morning, everyone. Welcome to the Safety and Service Delivery Committee meeting. I'd like to start the meeting off by turning the floor over to Metro's Chief Safety Officer, Pat Lavin, for today's safety contact. Pat?
Good morning. In case of an emergency, please egress to the main doors or closest emergency exit illuminated by an exit sign, assemble on the lawn of the National Building Museum across the street. An AED is available behind the guard station. Fire extinguishers are strategically located throughout the building. Restrooms are past the guard desk on the left. March is designated as Red Cross Month. In addition to supplying about 40% of the nation's blood, the Red Cross also provides shelter, food, and emotional support during emergencies and disasters. The following is a public service announcement describing one of the many ways you can support the Red Cross.
Right? Think about everything that you save. You save gas, you save money, you save time. But have you ever thought about saving life? That's right, life. In just 1 hour, you could save up to 3 lives, giving 3 people more time with the ones they love. And isn't that the best thing to save? The need for blood is as universal as it is constant. Save life, give blood.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lavin. Now let's look at the committee's administrative business for the day. First item of business is to approve today's agenda, but I'd like to request that we amend the agenda slightly to include 2 verbal updates from Mr. Lavin. The first on the status of the investigation into the January 15th Red Line derailment, and then the second verbal update on the classification of track defects, which was the subject of a recent Washington Post article. Do members of the committee have any issues with this, or do they concur? Hearing no objections, we'll go ahead and approve the agenda. Let's go to the approval of the minutes from February 8th, 2018. I'd like to ask for a motion for a committee member to approve the minutes of our February 8th session. Can I get a motion? Second?
Second.
All right. All in favor? Aye. Okay. The minutes are approved. So thank you, everyone. We've addressed the committee's administrative business, and we can begin our meeting today. As I noted, Mr. Lavin is going to provide us with 2 updates, the first on the status of the investigation into January 15th, derailment of the Red Line, and the second on Metro's process for classifying track defects. After Mr. Lavin's 2 updates, we'll proceed with the written agenda. Mr. Lavin.
Good morning. As Mr. Lobby stated, we're going to start with the Farragut North derailment that occurred on January 15, 2018. This briefing is divided into 4 key areas. It's derailment causation, process improvements, communications, and passenger safety. As far as derailment causation, with regard to the cause of the derailment, the most significant update to report to the board is that Metro has received the final report performed by the consultant. Dr. Zaremski reviewed various internal and external reports and data to reach his conclusion. The following is a summary of that report. There was no issues with the composition of the rail based on the metallurgist report performed by Dr. Stone. In addition, Dr. Zaremski concurs with the metallurgist report, which states that this incident was a result of corrosion pitting on the underside of the base of the rail. The pitting eventually escalated into a fatigue crack. The fatigue crack was the result of vertical bending or cyclical loading of the rail by WMATA trains and was supplemented by the temperature and possibly by mechanically induced tensile longitudinal stresses. Dr. Zaremski states that there was some longitudinal movement of the rail. However, this movement was not considered to be a major factor in the initiation or propagation of the fatigue crack. The report states that this type of failure would have been undetectable with conventional ultrasonic testing as it will not pick up a corrosion pit in the base of the rail, and Dr. Zaremski is not aware of any industry-accepted inspection technology that can detect a corrosion pit at the base of the rail. Further, a corrosion pit, such as the one that initiated the fatigue failure, is not visible to a track inspector since it is at the bottom of the base of the rail. The report indicates that 85 to 90% of rail defects are found through inspection technologies, primarily through ultrasonic testing. While visual inspections will find broken rails, they will do so at a rate less than that of automated testing. If anyone has any questions on this piece before I move on.
Thank you, Mr. Lavin. So essentially what we're looking at is we're looking at a fatigue crack that started from a corrosion pit area at the bottom of the rail.
The bottom of the base of the rail, yes.
At the base of the rail. Okay, and we have a report that provides, you know, that analysis, and that hasn't been distributed to the full board, as to my knowledge, but certainly can we look forward to a full discussion on this in the future?
Yes, the plan is to brief out and finalize the report by next month.
By next month and talk about all the issues and the options. So I have seen the report. It's somewhat complicated, the explanations, but hopefully in the next month we can see what the way forward is for this particular issue. Correct. Any other questions here? Jeff?
Can I just follow up with that? So this corrosion is essentially not detectable by best industry practices, and this corrosion occurred on a rail on a curve in the WMATA system, and I think the other ingredient present was, I assume, humidity or some change in temperature that would lead to the corrosion, create conditions that would produce some corrosion at the base of the rail. Is that fairly accurate?
It's fairly accurate, except the only thing I would state is that the weather or the humidity doesn't necessarily add to the corrosion, but once you get the break, if the rail is under tension because of the cold weather, that once you get the break, it pulls apart more rapidly because of the tension.
So my question is, how do we find out that we don't have other rails on curved sections that are in areas where there's the potential for water that would cause corrosion in the system? How do we go through some inspection process that gives us a higher level of confidence that there aren't any other sections of curved rail out there that are susceptible to the same type of default?
Okay, so this type of failure is extremely rare. The next part of my presentation will talk about process improvements, so you reduce the risk of another broken rail and the process itself.
That's what I'd be interested in hearing, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So as part of the safety initiatives discussion, we'll be talking about process improvements, and I want to note that during next month's board briefing, I'll be briefing out at these safety initiatives in greater detail. That's already on the calendar. All right, so what some of the actions we're doing to improve the process and reduce the likelihood of track defects in general and to some degree broken rails is we'll be doing tie scanning, which is the support for the rail system. That is scheduled to occur in mid-March of 2018, so within the next few weeks. We also have high-resolution cameras. That scanning commenced on February 20th. 49% of the system is done already. A system sweep will be completed by March 20th, 2018, and then the vendor will provide an analysis of the data. This technology is useful in identifying specifically things like broken joint bars that can lead to derailments. We're also doing lateral load testing, which commenced on January 20th, 2018. It was completed on March 4th of this year. We're awaiting the final test results. And we're also considering the frequency of our current ultrasonic testing program. Trist Engineering is doing an analysis of the ultrasonic test data to determine the appropriate frequency of system-wide testing. As I briefed out after the incident happened, we're kind of trying to look at the FRA model, which is you base the number of testing based on a ratio of broken rails in a certain segment of track. So we're doing that analysis based upon the data that we're collecting through this most frequent UT run. Does anybody have any questions on this portion?
Any other additional questions on this? Thank you, Mr. Lavin. We'll look forward to, you know, the full discussion in the coming months.
Bob, I had two more pieces, if you...
All right, go ahead.
Indulge me.
Go ahead. I don't want to cut you off, you know. Go ahead.
All right, so the next is the communications piece, which was problematic in the incident. So right now we've done six full scans of the uplink and downlink of the system for both the public and the internal system. The seven sweep is in progress. Right now, today, there is no public radio issues. We have three internal, and typically when we get these, once they're identified, we get emergency track rights and we address them. And we also have, you know, every 800 feet in the tunnel, there is a blue light available. if there's a communication issue. And the last piece I want to talk about is the passenger safety piece, because when we analyze the time it took to get the passengers off the train, we think we can do a better job in the future by just taking off power and immediately going to a ground evacuation and a derailment. We'd probably save somewhere between 45 minutes and an hour in this type of event. So that's organizationally we're doing that. Now we just have to mirror the PIs to match that philosophy. That's all I have.
Okay. Thank you once again, Mr. Lavin. It sounds like you got all the bases covered right now. Any questions on any of this? Thank you. So let's go on to the next subject.
Okay, so the next subject is going to be black conditions. There's obviously a heightened sensitivity around this following the Washington Post article this weekend. So I'd like to start off by I want to wish to thank the FDA for the continued insistence in their role of oversight. FDA has been a tremendous asset to our organization in improving the agency's performance. For clarity, WMATA does not dispute the classification FDA inspectors made during their inspections within the system. And I want to emphasize that we will not hesitate to take a track out of service anytime conditions warrant it. However, there appears to be a misconception that a black maintenance condition requires that the track be removed from service. This is not always the case. Of the 27 conditions identified by FDA inspectors, only two required that the track be immediately removed from service, while 12 required speed restrictions and the remaining 13 did not require restrictions or fixed before service commenced in the morning. It should be noted that in 2017, our internal track inspection program identified 295 conditions that required speed restrictions be put in place. Of the 295 occurrences, 58 were black safety defects that required the track be taken out of service. Please allow me to explain the process of cataloging track defects and how the agency reacts to these conditions. Defects fall into two categories. Maintenance defects, this is a condition where the component is still performing its intended function, i.e. it's holding gauge, cross level, under load. And the second one is a safety defect where the performance of the component may actually be affected. Currently, both types of defects are rated in the track by track inspectors as green, yellow, red, and black. The defects are input into our maximal database as part of our internal business practices to prioritize work, schedule maintenance, and affect repairs. One example of a black maintenance defect can be an instance where there are four ties in a row that contain defects that do not affect the function of a tie. From a maintenance perspective, four defective ties in a row would be a black condition. However, in this instance, the nature of the defects do not affect gauge course level or stability of track under load. So I'll give you a kind of a layman's example of this. Let's assume I want to rent the vehicle. As part of renting the vehicle, I may have to walk around the vehicle and denote defects such as dents, scratches. Those don't affect the operation of the motor vehicle. If I identified a flat tire, that would be a safety defect where I couldn't operate the vehicle. So there's a distinction between how we're cataloging a maintenance versus a safety defect. Therefore, although there may be black maintenance conditions present that require prioritization and scheduling of repairs down the road, there would not necessarily be a requirement to immediately implement a speed restriction or remove the track from service. Speed restrictions are only applied when defective components create a safety condition. While the TRIST 1000 manual, that's our track inspection manual, makes a distinction between a safety and maintenance defect, the color black can be associated with both. And I agree, that is confusing. Therefore, we'll be working on a revision to the manual that will be rolled out this year that will no longer use the same color scales to refer to both maintenance conditions and conditions that require speed restriction to eliminate the confusion. In addition, we are pleased to announce that the defects referenced in the Washington Post article at Braddock Road were corrected as scheduled during the last weekend shutdown, which had been planned for months in advance.
Thank you, Mr. Lavin. You know, there is a difference between a black maintenance and a black service condition. The two are not equal, and I think there is a bit of confusion on this. But as we go ahead and modify the track maintenance standards, you know, in our discussion before the meeting, you pointed out that because of the way we collect data, we want to make sure that we can link this data to historical data. You know, not change horses in the middle of the stream so that we lose that historic perspective. Is that going to be possible with the revisions to the track safety standards?
We're analyzing that now, Bob. So hopefully by next month I can tell you where we are with it, but we're working on it rigorously to get that done.
And are we close to the end for modifying the standards? Are we a month, 2 months, 6 months? Where are we?
You want to answer that?
We're close. I think by the beginning of the summer we'll have this first 1,000 out. It was in its final draft when this came up, so we're taking a look at it. So it's not just changing one chart. There's a possibility there's going to be other paragraphs within the TRIS 1000 that need to be modified, so we need to go through it one more time as we make this last change. So I think by the beginning of the summer, we should have it out.
Very good. I think it's important to get that document cleaned up and in place. I did want to point out one other thing. We have a regular briefing from FTA before we have a board meeting, at least the federal members do, to be aware of the things going on. And as part of that, FTA told us that they were not in disagreement with any of the classifications that Metro was using. So there is no disagreement on the fact that they were appropriately, those conditions were appropriately classified. Do we have any questions from other members of the committee or members of the board? Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. Our next presentation, the first one on the actual agenda, is an overview and update of the Abilities Ride program, which provides Metro Access customers in Maryland with a flexible alternative to paratransit service. The service has been operating for approximately 6 months, and today's staff is going to be sharing both the results of the 6 months of service as well as plans for the program's next step.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Christian Blake, Director of ADA Policy and Planning, acting in the role of Access Services as well at the moment. This presentation is an update on the Abilities Ride program, our latest paratransit alternative to give customers who are eligible for Metro Access an alternative to the more expensive but ADA-required paratransit service. We're going to give you the results of the first 6 months and Metro's next steps to help grow the program for the benefit and success of both the customers and the agency. The program is a taxi-based program at the moment. It serves trips that begin and end in Maryland. We could expand that later as results dictate. The customers pay the first $5 a fare. Metro pays the next $15. And then the customer is responsible for any fare above $20. These are direct trips. They don't require the shared ride that is on Metro Access as the public service that it is. Advanced reservations are not required but strongly encouraged, although on-demand service is available as well. Customers are allowed to take up to 4 trips per day. There are wheelchair-accessible vehicles for customers who require such service. And drivers have been verified to have met the state-required background checks for taxi cab drivers, and Metro, through the solicitation process, required that drivers be trained to proficiency in serving customers with disabilities. This slide here really shows what we've been trying to do here at Metro, which is paratransit, in our belief, is the safety net, as the FTA and the ADA has outlined for the last 25 years or so, 23, I would say, customers with disabilities, in a lot of cases, only had Metro Access as their alternative service, as their one and only service. So we began trying to facilitate larger alternatives in other parts of the region. So we always start with bus and rail. That's our goal, is to make sure our bus and rail service is fully accessible for all customers with disabilities. But in those cases where a person's disability just prevents them from using bus and rail for a trip, we started with transport, in terms of the Metro-facilitated alternatives. I want to be clear on that. We started with Transport DC in Washington, D.C., that I believe a lot of people consider to be a success at this point in time. That's a taxi-based service. We've now moved to Abilities Ride in Maryland. But for the longest time, we've had two van alternatives in Virginia, and they should be commended in that STAR and FASTRAN for providing alternatives to metro access. When these type of alternatives are not the solution for the customer, then metro access should be the safety net. So we're trying to move people from left to right, not the other way around, as ridership is showing that it could be at this time. So when we began Abilities Ride in the September 18th of 2017, following a long and very detailed solicitation process, we selected two partners for this program, Regency Taxi and Silver Cab. Both companies, both are cab companies. One is based out of Montgomery County. One is out of Prince George's County. However, customers in either county can choose either provider for this program. Both companies allow reservations by phone, web, and mobile apps. Both companies have wheelchair-accessible vehicles available for service. They both accept cash and credit. And the minimum fare, again, is that $5 fare. On Regency Taxi, that will get you about 9 miles. On Silver Cab, that would get you about 7 miles. However, on Silver Cab, if you're going a much shorter distance, whereas in Regency you pay the flat $5 regardless of distance, on Silver Cab, if you're going shorter distance, you could pay $2, $3, $4. So customers have a choice in terms of which company would best suit their needs for their specific trip. So we began this, as I said, in September of 2017. We began it with a soft launch. And just like with Transport DC, we began with a soft launch there. That soft launch was based on customers who were traveling to and from dialysis facilities only, were the only ones allowed to use the service at the beginning. With Abilities Ride, we didn't do it that way. We just selected a number of high-using Metro Access customers to target. If they all would have adopted, we would have great ridership, but probably some other challenges. But knowing that there would be the opportunity for high-frequent users to try this out and perhaps adopt to it, those were the folks we targeted. And the reason for the soft launch strategy, just to say, is that no matter how good proposals look, no matter how good potential vendors sound, you never really know what you have when you're beginning these programs until you have real wheels on the streets providing service to real-world customers. And we use this strategy to get feedback. How do we improve this service before we bring a whole lot of people or try to encourage a whole lot of people to use the service? But the 6 months, we received a lot of feedback. We shared and we dialogued together with the customers, but also just the Metro and the cab providers directly. Cab providers have been very responsive in making the necessary adjustments as they learn the needs of the Metro Access customers. We've done some outreach, did one postcard, several robocalls, and that has allowed the ridership to steadily, slowly, but as we've seen now, it's starting to pick up pace. Through those first 6 months, we've done 8,219 trips. 475 of the trips required wheelchair-accessible vehicles. There were over about 500 individual customers who've taken those trips. And on the right, you see a graph. And I only included that graph to show the pace of our soft launch for Transport DC, which after that, the same point had done about, was doing about 1,500 trips in a month. And we know that has grown to over 20,000 trips in its strongest month. So I wanted you to see the pace that we're on with Abilities Ride and show you that this has a lot of potential if we continue down the same successful pathway we used in Transport DC. Customers are really enjoying it. Again, there are feedback, but I think they appreciate the responsiveness of both Metro and the cab companies when they do have feedback that's less than positive. But they're ready for more. So what is Metro going to do now to really make this a success beyond a soft launch and pilot, but a success for the customers at large as well as the agency in terms of our own internal goals? Well, we're going to begin with a significant marketing campaign supported by our marketing team that has done a great job on many other projects, as you all are well aware. And we're going to really lean on them to reach out to the to the broad-based customers. The goal is to have all 22,000 Maryland-based customers really fully aware of the program, although this program, you're eligible if you're a Metro Access customer. You just have to, if you're in Virginia, if you live in Virginia, but you happen to have a trip that's going to start and end in Maryland, you're eligible for this program. But the real key constituency at the moment are the Maryland residents who are eligible for Metro Access. Our goal, beginning March 1st until to next February 28th, is to see 150,000 or more trips taken by Metro Access customers. And we're starting, again, with broad marketing to all the customers, but we're going to be really targeting. If we were doing some things already, there's on the screen is a picture of the refrigerator magnet that we're sending to about 1,200 customers. We're giving away another 3,500 of those magnets to Maryland residents who are becoming newly eligible to Metro Access, and we're going to give away about another 1,000 at several Metro-sponsored community forums and community meetings where we're going to educate them about the program. And then there's a few other highlighted marketing activities we're doing. The 22,000, 95% of them, we want them to be aware of it. And later this month or next month or so, we're going to look at perhaps what we call incentivizing customers to try the trip, try the program, and not just for one trip, but several trips. And if we think if they take several trips like what we do with travel training on fixed route service, we're not going to incentivize them just to take 10 random trips. We know where several customers, many of our customers are beginning their trips, where they're ending the trips, and we want to incentivize them by giving them the opportunity to take many of their daily trips they're currently taking with Metro Access through the Abilities Ride program and see if that works for them. And we believe, as we've seen in Washington, D.C., a number of customers will find the direct trip on a cab favorable to Metro Access and it fulfills their transportation needs. So that's our efforts to reach out more specifically to the customers and reach our goal of 150,000 trips between last Thursday and next February 28th. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your report, Mr. Blake. So in summary, this Abilities Ride program, this is essentially a more cost-effective alternative to Metro Access, and that's already given us about $287,000 in savings. Is that correct?
Approximately.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Can I ask you, how did you select the two participants, Regency and Silver? Do they have certain things they have to comply with or to qualify for this program?
Yes, sir. So we wrote a scope of work, and the scope of work was very basic. We had six basic requirements: accessible ways of reservation, background checks for drivers, training for drivers or serving customers with disability, wheelchair-accessible vehicles, either owned by the organization or available through partnerships, billing requirements in terms of tracking the trips in terms of giving customer information while the trip is en route, both to the customer as well as once the customer is in the vehicle. And just as important, we required specific data from every trip. So for companies that responded to the solicitation and agreed to those six parameters, we then invited them to share with us their pricing. And they would share a price. If it was a price that was worth Metro's administrative effort to do this, then we allow them to be a partner in this program.
Very good. We have some questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Blake. Can you talk a little bit about how you're going to evaluate this? Will it be ongoing, or will you have an evaluation at the end of the pilot period?
It's ongoing, but also we're going to be even more aggressive in terms of hearing from our customers, especially now we're going to have many, many more out there. We're going to launch a mystery rider program as well. So we're going to encourage customers to put aside their Metro Access trips, try this program, but in doing so, if you give us specific feedback, were you able to reserve on the phone or on the app or on the web? Did you have any technical problems? Did the driver provide you the service quality? Did you get a chance to rate the drive? You know, give us specific feedback in our Mystery Rider program. That's going to enable us on a monthly basis to give feedback to the companies, specific companies, but also to the program at whole in terms of areas we believe may need some improvement. The overall, in terms of evaluation of the success or failure, is really going to be the ridership numbers and the impact on Metro Access ridership. What we don't want is to see 150,000 trips on Abilities Ride and next year 3 million trips on Metro Access. That kind of defeats the purpose. But we want to see 150,000 or more trips on Abilities Ride, a reduction in Metro Access ridership, and positive feedback and continued repeated use by the customers. That would really tell us if this is a success or not.
Great, thanks. And can you just clarify, the trips need to originate and end in the primary jurisdiction where each of the companies is located? Is that right?
No, sir. The trips have to begin and end in Maryland. And that's where we are right now, but we could change that in the future, but we'll see. But if I'm a resident of New Carrollton, if I live in New Carrollton and I know I'm going 8 or 9 miles, I have a right to call Regency out of Montgomery because I know that pricing is better for me. If I'm a resident of Bethesda and I know I'm going 2 miles, I have a right to call Silver Cab because I know I would pay less than the $5 I would pay on Regency. Now, every decision won't be just on price. There's quality and comfort and other aspects to a customer's decision making. But no, each company has a partner organization in the other jurisdiction. So customers have the freedom to choose whichever company is most responsive to their desires as a consumer.
Great, thanks.
Yes, thank you for your presentation. On this slide, it says that the wheelchair vehicles for Regency are 77 and 13 for Silver Cab. That seems like a large disparity between the two jurisdictions that are servicing these clients, specifically because Prince George's County predominantly has a larger majority of people who will probably need wheelchair vehicles. Can you explain the discrepancy and what, if any, solutions are currently underway to equalize that number?
So, as we said in the solicitation, companies can either own or partner to have wheelchair-accessible vehicles available to the customer. At the moment, what's happening, because the ridership in the soft launch has been lower than we hope to grow it eventually, Silver Cab, these are the vehicles directly owned by Silver Cab. They have companies they're ready to partner with. One, I should say, well, like for example, I'll give an example of a potential partner. It's Prince George's Ark that has many wheelchair-accessible vehicles that during the middle of the day can be utilized for this program. What's going on at the moment is, until the ridership picks up, it would be more costly for Silver Cab and even Regency, because Regency is ready to increase that number as well through partnerships. But until the ridership really picks up, the cost to provide partnerships and the cost to have these vehicles available to them that may likely not be used at the moment is not to the company's advantage. When we market heavily, when we bring in the ridership that will justify not only their sedan fleet to be increased, but the wheelchair accessible vehicle fleet, those numbers will reflect that reaction by the companies.
Is there any concern that during that transition period there will be issues with wheelchair vehicles not being readily available?
Not concerned, if you will, because we've been monitoring the response times and making sure equity is part of this program. We are watching, and the customers we're targeting, we're letting both companies know who are the customers, and even just in case, because a lot of customers at this point are used to Metro Access coming with a wheelchair-accessible vehicle, so they may not say it. So we're informing the companies, if this customer A calls, no, even if they don't say it, no, they need a wheelchair-accessible vehicle. So when the reservations are made, when the on-demand reservations are made, the companies are aware of those particular companies. I mean, excuse me, customers. So at this point, knock on wood, we haven't had direct complaints that wheelchair accessible vehicles have not been available. We're going to continue to work with our partners as we grow the marketing and as we encourage many more customers to try it. We're going to work with our partners to ensure they're aware of the customers, and we're going to educate the customers to help educate the companies as well on their needs ahead of time. We're going to be monitoring that. That's one of the key metrics of our measurements. In addition to the agency goals, one of our key metrics is to ensure that we don't hear complaints and find evidence that there's been inequity in terms of customers who need wheelchair accessible vehicles versus those who can be transported in sedans.
Thank you. I think that would be something very important to stay on top of, because as people are coming, hopefully in the numbers that we would like, we would hate for them to be turned off by the inability to actually use the service we're marketing. My second question is in regards to these two providers. Can you explain the contracted dates for utilizing these companies and whether or not they're the exclusive participants, and whether or not others will in the future be able to participate or currently can participate? How does that process work?
So the scope of work and solicitation was created with the intention that it would be open. Companies that agree to those parameters and offer a price that's worth our administrative costs would be allowed to join at a later time. However, we have to make sure in doing that, we have to make sure we adhere to all procurement rules in terms of these two companies stepped up first. Do we just allow other companies immediately to come in? That I have to consult more with my procurement colleagues. At some point, I would love to see as many companies as possible. That's from an ADA warning paratransit to be the safety net perspective. But we do have procurement rules I have to adhere to and monitor in terms of how we add people. So the contract these two companies have right now, one year contracts for both with four option years. And can we add another company at the end of the first year, at the end of the second year? Would that require a new solicitation? Those are questions we have to answer internally. We've had these discussions, but those are questions we have to answer internally. But right now, these two companies have stepped up. They've agreed to the parameters Metro outlined. They've provided pricing that is very reasonable. And we want to grow the ridership and see them meet the capacity that we hope will materialize over these next 12 months.
Okay. Is there any way, I know that you said reviewing the service will be an ongoing thing, but from the board perspective, that a report out could be integrated so that if and when those questions are answered, we will have enough time to open it up to other companies if possible, or heighten what we're requesting from those companies in a reasonable amount of time. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Blake? Thank you very much, Mr. Blake. The next presentation is going to look at alternatives to add peak period service on the western leg of the Red Line. These alternatives will be reviewed with the public over the next few months, with information gathered, presented to the board for a decision in July. And before we go to the presentation, I'd like to ask Mr. Goldman if he might provide us a little bit of perspective on why we're talking about this.
I'll give it a shot. Thank you. While I wasn't present at the creation, I was present in 2015 when this subject of the Red Line turnbacks was discussed and decided by the board. What was happening at that time were two or three things. First, the board was in the midst of ordering some additional 7,000 rail cars, and most were replacement, but there was a small number of those cars that would be available for some additional expansion. Second of all, our colleagues in Virginia wanted to get started with a project to increase power upgrades on the blue and orange lines so that those lines would be able to sustain eight-car train service at some point in the future. In addition, at that time, and in connection with that, the blue and orange lines, there was an additional ask of the jurisdictions of $25 million apiece to partially finance the upgrades. So as part of that discussion, where Virginia wanted to go ahead with the power upgrades, and Maryland said, well, our priority here is at some point to eventually end these Grosvenor turnbacks on the west side of the Red Line. The arrangement that was agreed among the jurisdictions is that we would go ahead and order the additional 7,000 rail cars, recognizing that the additional cars available for expansion service would be coming at the end of the buy period. At this time, during 1918, and we agreed, Maryland, to match Virginia and our colleagues in the district, the $25 million needed to begin the power upgrades on the blue and orange line in Virginia. So essentially, Virginia was able to get the benefit of an early start on the upgrade, on the power upgrades for the orange and blue lines, with the understanding that when the rail cars were available, which is the case now, that Maryland would get what its service improvement priority was, which is the ending of the Grosvenor turnbacks on the Red Line. I think that's basically the history. If my colleague from Montgomery County thinks I've missed something, I'm sure he'll give me a little note, and I'll correct it during the Q&A.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Goldman. I know I kind of put you on the spot, but I think it's important to understand the perspective here, and that these are commitments that were made some time ago, before certainly before I was here, but it kind of puts the presentation in perspective. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Leader to walk us through.
Sure, thank you. This is a board information item that will describe alternatives to increase rail service on the Red Line during peak periods between Shady Grove and White Flint stations. This alternative service is being reviewed as directed by Board Resolution 2015-37. This slide describes the existing peak service level on the Red Line during the AM and the PM rush hours. Presently, during the peak periods, Metro provides more frequent service between Grosvenor and through downtown by turning every other train utilizing the pocket track just north of Grosvenor Station. This is commonly called the Grosvenor Turnback. Between Shady Grove and White Flint, we operate 7 to 8 trains per hour on an 8-minute headway, and south of Grosvenor into the core, that service is doubled with 15 trains per hour on a 4-minute headway. A similar operation exists on the B line between Glenmont and Silver Spring stations. This table shows the history of the service levels to Shady Grove. The segment on the Red Line between Shady Grove and White Flint opened in 1984. Peak service was operated 10 trains per hour or a 6-minute headway. Note, off-peak service has always been, and even today, is at a 12-minute headway. Between April 2004 and June of 2007, service was increased to 12 trains per hour or a 5-minute headway out of Shady Grove and a 2.5-minute headway through downtown. Performance during this period was extremely poor. In addition to trying to operate too many trains, there were other issues that caused poor performance. No more station open, which, you know, added some additional time to the schedule. And then the accident of 2009, resulting in moving to a manual operation, which slowed down service and reduced performance. In 2010, we returned to a 6-minute, 3-minute headway. Service improved, but the performance was somewhat spotty. We were still in manual operation. The overall running time was insufficient. In June of last year, we implemented the new 8-minute peak headway, which corrected running times, as a result, service has improved. Currently, the Red Line is now operating at 92% schedule adherence. Staff has prepared 3 alternatives to be analyzed. Option A, operate all peak trains to Shady, eliminating the turn back at Grosvenor, resulting in 15 trains per hour or 4-minute headway out of Shady Grove. Option B would be a partial elimination of the turn back, resulting in 12 trains per hour on an uneven headway. This eliminates half of the current turn back operation and only Every fourth train would turn at the Grosvenor to maintain 15 trains per hour in the downtown area. And option C would retain the existing service pattern that we are currently running today. This is a depiction off our ROCS map of the current operation. If you look on the left-hand side, you don't see it, but that's Shady Grove Yard. So trains will come from the left to the right into Shady Grove Station. One of our concerns with the increase in frequency is the operation at Shady Grove Station and the potential impact on performance. This slide shows the operation at Shady Grove and Grosvenor. The next slide will show the impact of increased service at Shady Grove. The top slide shows the current service at Shady Grove with 7 to 8 trains per hour. Pictured here, as you can see, train 166 just arrived at Shady Grove from downtown and is sitting on the pocket on track 2. Train 00, which is shown in purple, just came out of the yard and is getting ready for service. Train 101 is at Rockville heading towards Shady Grove. The next train movements that would occur is train 166 would leave Shady Grove and cross over from track 2 to track 1. Train 101 would then proceed into Shady Grove station on track 2. And then train 00, once it leaves the station, would get a new identity and start heading into service downtown. The bottom shows the current operation at Grosvenor and how the turnback function works. Pictured here, train 166 just arrived at White Flint and is headed towards Shady Grove from downtown. Train 110 is at Medical Center heading towards Grosvenor. Train 821 in purple is in the pocket track because it just offloaded at Grosvenor and is getting ready to head back south. Train 102 just left Grosvenor Station heading downtown, and train 104 just left White Flint heading towards Grosvenor. The next train movements that would occur is 821 would leave the pocket, heading downtown, stopping at Grosvenor Station first, picking up customers, and then heading downtown on track 1. And train 104 will follow, coming out of the pocket and proceeding downtown. This slide shows the simulated service at Shady Grove if you run 15 trains per hour and you do not have the Grosvenor turnback. Train 166 just arrives at Shady Grove from downtown. Train 156 just left Rockville, heading towards Shady Grove on track 2. And train 101 is entering Rockville Station. And train 160 is at Rockville Station heading downtown. As you see, as you add more trains going to Shady Grove, what begins to happen is what we would call what's occurring at train 156 is what we call a terminal holdout. Since both station pocket tracks are being occupied, it cannot get in there and will be held outside. The next train movements will take place. Train 166 will leave Shady Grove and switch from track 2 to track 1 heading downtown. Train 156 will then enter Shady Grove track 2. Train 000 will go into service towards downtown and follow train 166 4 minutes later. Train 101 will proceed to Shady Grove Station, switching from track 2 to track 1, and then train 156 will proceed from track 2 to track 1 and proceed downtown 4 minutes after train 166. Staff is undertaking 2 studies which will identify actions to be taken to maintain service reliability if this takes place. We are identifying operational initiatives that would help to ensure reliable service. These initiatives should include additional staff to move trains on and off the platform, bring in extra tower supervision to maintain smooth operations between the yard and the station, and procedures to recover quickly when incidents occur. Also, to identify potential infrastructure improvements, staff will conduct an engineering effort to identify improvements that would help with performance. Types of improvements would include interlocking improvements, going from a standard 8 maybe to a 10 or 15 type switch. Improvements also by installing possibly another pocket track behind Shady Grove alongside the yard tracks, and signal improvements. This effort will also identify potential improvements at the station, like additional stairways to improve passenger flow. Any infrastructure improvement identified could be included in future capital program. Here is a schedule of deliverables that staff needs to address. During March and April, we will begin to develop the outreach material that will go to the public. The public input and comment period will be in May. We will conduct the required Title VI analysis between now and June. And finally, we will return to this committee in July with the results of the public outreach as well as the Title VI report. As just stated, we will return to Safety and Service Committee in July to report out the results of the public participation and the Title VI analysis and the recommendation of the operational analysis. Based on the board direction, this item will also be presented to the July Finance Committee for a financial year 2019 budget amendment. If increased service is improved, the next steps are to prepare implementation, including acquiring and training additional operators, formalizing the schedule and the union pick, and informing the public. The earliest implementation of additional service would take place then around December of 2018. And that is my report.
Thank you very much, Mr. Leader. So it seems to me that looking at any type of changes in service, more frequent service, I assume, would improve ridership, but more congestion would probably have a detrimental effect on ridership. So trying to balance those requirements with the plans that you have proposed. It sounds like in order to make this work that there would be some infrastructure improvements needed at Shady Grove. Is that right?
Correct.
And is a pocket track, is that really what's needed in order for it to operate like Grosvenor or what?
It would help with congestion. By having a train pull into Shady Grove Station after it offloads and then go into a pocket track, will now free up that additional track to bring extra trains in. So the pocket track would probably be the answer to the solution that we need up there.
And I assume whether it's pocket track or something else?
Yes, 15 trains per hour.
Okay. If it's a pocket track or something else, that there will be some estimates on what the cost might be to make those changes?
Yeah, that will be part of the study.
Okay. My other question has to do with basically the public outreach. How is that going to be accomplished? Is that a hearing or is it surveys or what?
It's no public hearing. It will be just our people reaching out to the public in that area. And then we'll be bringing back your analysis. But it doesn't require a public hearing.
Surveys?
Yes.
Is that what we're talking about, written surveys or things like that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Questions from the committee members?
Yes. Good.
Thank you for your presentation. This item, information item, is the result of a board resolution, correct? So I guess my questions are more in line with that. The board resolution directed that, first of all, that there would be a proposal for the elimination of turnbacks. I don't see any alternate options that were provided for in the resolution. So can you explain to me why alternative B and alternative C are part of the study?
I think what we're looking to do is, as we did before, we went to the 8-minute, we looked at ridership, and look at what service we should provide based on the ridership that we have. So I think, to be fair, that's what we want to do. We want to look at the ridership, look at some of the operational issues that we have, make a determination whether or not grocery is the best thing to do right now, or is it something we should do further down the road.
My understanding of the resolution was that wasn't the direction that the board gave to staff. The direction that the board gave to staff was to consider a proposal with no S for the elimination of the turnbacks with a planned implementation date prior to the beginning of FY 2019. These are three proposals with a report date of July 2018, which is a month before FY 2019, with an implementation date of December 2018, which is approximately 2 months after 2019. So I'm trying very hard to understand how this complies with our resolution.
Well, the resolution was back in 2015 when I was here. I first came here in 2007. service, to modify service based on what the right should hold at this current time. Now, we'll change that and get more additional service of shading the road without doing an analysis based on the right should be fair to the work that we just did. So that's how I'd ask staff to proceed.
So, because the resolution was before your time here, does that negate its instructions?
No, I just think we just went through a pretty exhaustive study on why it's here to go from a 6-minute headway to an 8-minute headway, and now we're going to be looking to change service. I just think, what we did earlier this year, I think or last year, against everything just did. So I just feel, in all fairness to staff, the work that they're doing, we've given them goals and objectives, how we should proceed with service and the direction, I think we're going against that.
Is there a safety concern with the implementation of Proposal A that warrants Proposal B?
Proposal A will increase the budget, will require more trains, will require more operators, so that all has a budget impact. We go with more trains to shape growth as the A grows to term.
I asked if there was a safety concern with Proposal A.
I wouldn't necessarily categorize it as a safety concern. When you start adding more ridership like that and you have an event, then it leads to secondary effects, where you can now have more operational violations because you're turning back and it's much more difficult to recover. And I also was not here in 2015, but as an observer, I think it would be delinquent on our part if we didn't provide all these options to the board than just stick to an hour interpretation of the resolution. That's just my opinion.
But in 2015, when the resolution was made, the staff was aware that this was, as Mr. Goldman stated so eloquently in his opening, this was coming down the line when the more trains were put into service. So this is not a gotcha moment. This is something that Metro staff should have been preparing for as they were moving through the rest of their proposal.
Can I just kind of respond to that? That is just, I just can't, we're the board. There's a resolution. It is not your job to interpret the resolution. It's your job to implement. Now, if we need to make a change, if you want to suggest that we make a change, that hasn't been done. I'm looking at the people who signed off on this, and many of them are actually in this room. It was Ms. Hudgens, Mr. Goldman, Ms. Harley. Mr. Corcoran has now joined us, and it was made as a compromise, as it were, so that we could get these power upgrades done. Is that not correct, Ms. Hudgens? I mean, you were there. And part of that, and the investment, Mr. Leader, that Maryland made in Metro, part of the investment that Maryland made in Metro, this was one of the requirements. This is the reason why we do board resolutions. And so I just want to dovetail on what Ms. Hartley said, which is that the job is to implement here. Now, you can give us a recommendation that we make a change, but the job is to implement the resolutions that the board has put forth. The board has given you direction. The board has given you direction in the form of this resolution, which is to eliminate the turnback by FY19. That's the direction. Now, if you have recommendations that there needs to be a change, I can understand that. I can appreciate that. But the direction and the commitment, from part of the commitment that the state of Maryland made to fund rail cars, was contingent on this condition. This is a decision that the board had to come to, is my understanding. And again, the people around the, including now we've been joined by Chair Evans, he was a part of that conversation as well. Unless this board, you know, I'm just struggling to understand how the decision that this board made, and by the way, we have a 1.8 billion, the budget. If we've got to figure out how we do this within, that's what I would look to you for. You figure out how we do this, we get this done, and we figure out what we have to do in order to make it work. That would be my expectation.
Thank you. You know, I'm going to weigh in on this also. I understand this is a priority for some of the jurisdiction of Maryland to get this, but I do believe that the options are on the table, and I think it's not realistic to make these changes without having all the information, you know, on the table, and I think that's what's been proposed here. If the board goes with option A, which is eliminate the turn back, then I think it's up to staff to at least let us know what those implications are if we have to make improvements at Shady River, whatever else, because we have to roll that into the budget and everything else. So I don't see this as staff, not following what the board instructed, but I do see them as trying to provide the information that we need to make the informed decision. Even if the informed decision has been made, we need to know the implications on budget and everything else and make sure that it's taken care of. So I understand the passion on this. You know, I would be, if I were a Maryland jurisdiction, I'd say, you know, this was promised, but we need to understand what the implications may be and make sure that we cover it in the budget and everything else to make sure that we're whole in the end. So I understand that. Any other questions? Ms. Hudgens.
Not a question, just a clarification. I have to say that what we have today is a clear description of what kind of decision we can make. It does not change the resolution. It is a proposal for us for evaluation. I agree with all of the information provided in terms of why we got here. And so the question is, and I will say, my recall does not describe the operational piece when the decision was originally made. We already understood what the turnback issue was in Maryland. We were only trying to figure out what was the best financial and operational piece to execute at the time, and so that's why we asked to come back here. Now, I think we come back with information, and I think your question really is when we come back in whatever that time frame is in order to make that decision. And I think that it says go to the Finance Committee as well, and so I think we do have the time to address the concerns that you've raised.
Mr. Lerner, can I just start first with your, I guess it's the second and then the third chart, history of service levels and performance? So I guess the key event between the second level you point out and the third was the Fort Totten accident, correct?
Sorry.
The Fort Totten accident that occurred in point, okay. But your chart does show that before the Fort Totten accident, Metro ran 12 trains per hour beyond Grosvenor to Shady Grove. Correct?
But I did say that the service performance was very important.
I'm going to get to that. And it also shows that you're running 10 trains an hour after the Fort Totten accident all the way through June of last year. Correct?
Yes.
Now, you're talking about performance, and I've looked through your presentation. These are very interesting descriptions, delays and congestion. I don't find an appendix that describes the data that's the basis for those conclusions. Did I miss something, or
no,
is that not, was that provided to the chair or somebody else before?
2010, we've had good data on service. When you went back prior to other years, years, they didn't use the current way that we track on-time, you know, performance now. They used a different method, which was called headway adherence. So I really had to rely on staff that have been here prior to and Jim Hughes is in the audience. He's been here for a long period of time in our planning department, and I used him, his guidance on what was service like, because we don't have the data, and it's not apples and apples. Even if I had the data, it was calculated differently back then, so I couldn't use data to go by. I had to go back to staff and ask them how was service on the red line when we ran these operations.
So was this just a bull session, or is there some kind of report or analysis so we can actually see the metric that you used to come to a summary of, you know, delays and congestion as opposed to improved service during the current period? Is there some document or analysis you can provide to the board members or the committees?
Okay.
So we can understand what's going on here?
When we come back in July, we'll have some more information.
That'd be helpful. Now, just in the third period, just before we went to the more recent lengthening of the headways on red line for 8 minutes, we also did that on the other lines as well. Now, and I assume that your performance measure before that change for the period 2010 through June 2017, delays for multiple reasons, would apply to the whole system. This was not a red line problem. This was the system since we went, you know, to manual control, and since we introduced Silver Line Phase 1, the service was pretty lousy. You know, we had delays across the board, correct?
Yes.
So this is not something that was exclusive to how you would run the system on the red line from Grosvenor to Shady Grove, was it?
No, no. This
thank you. That's all I wanted to know.
Okay.
Now, my colleagues have asked you about the options 1, 2, and 3. But you said that the reason you presented the three options, as I understand it, is because we went through this rejigging of the system in terms of the headways because of the reduction in ridership. And you wanted to see whether this was appropriate in light of the new paradigm, the new metrics or whatever it was. Is that a fair summary of your analysis?
Well, I think when we came to the board and we requested back last year to change the service pattern that we eventually had, it was based on ridership. I think I was assuming that all the board members were agreeing that thinking, the way that our, you know, leadership team is trying to, you know, improve performance here. And I, so when I asked staff to look at it, when I learned of the resolution, I said to give me options of what to do about achieving growth. That's why we prepared three options for you.
All right, so some of the other actions that the board took back then in 2015 were the power upgrades on the orange and blue lines. Did you ask staff to look at whether the changed reduction in service still necessitated that kind of capital expenditure on the for power upgrades on the blue and orange line?
We've talked, yes.
You've begun that analysis? You asked staff to take a look at this one action that the board put forward, resolved in 2015. I'm asking, there were other things that the board decided in that time.
The orange, blue, and silver are already ongoing.
I'm sorry?
The power upgrades on the silver, orange, and blue lines are already ongoing. So I'm not sure.
So you didn't ask staff to say whether we should continue those power upgrades in the future capital years?
No, I haven't asked them to stop. I think it's a good idea.
Good idea.
Yes.
And I take it you haven't asked staff to look at Silver Line Phase 2 and what kind of service we should be providing on Silver Line Phase 2 when it comes online in a year or two.
They're working on that right now.
They're working on that,
yes.
Dad? Okay. I wanted to ask you a question on, you were describing the schematics, and you have a operation at Shady Grove with increased service. Next one, please.
Next one.
Just a quick question. I guess what you're showing at the Shady Grove, and am I right, is that the white is the platform?
Yes.
At the Shady Grove station. And so there's the X's, I guess, are crossovers. And I think what the diagram is showing, the schematic is showing, is that there's a crossover both before the platform as well as a crossover after the platform. And so I guess trains going from Grosvenor to Shady Grove can either do the crossover before they reach the platform, or they can go through the platform
and then make the crossover to come back heading from Shady Grove to Grosvenor. Is that the way you would handle it? Right.
The yard means, so we would be stacking trains on the yard team, okay, in order to get service ramped up. So we would not be able to use the back crossover, on the AM or the PM rush. You could do that operation that you just described, say midday or late at night, if there was a failure of interlocking on the right-hand side of the Shady Grove. You could use the one in the back. But when you have AM and PM rushes, you're beginning to ramp up, you're stacking your large. So it becomes a little bit more difficult.
But I'm just trying to understand the operational feasibility that both interlocks or crossovers could be used. I mean, the signaling is the same for both of them, so they're both capable of moving a train from one track to the other in the same amount of time. You know, one is not old technology, so it's not as efficient as the other interlock. Is that correct? Okay. And just a final question. On the public participation slide, you're projecting a timeline of coming back to the board in July with a report. And so I guess that means that the board, since it usually takes off in August, could act on this in some capacity and, reaffirm what the board decided in 2015 in September. I'm trying to understand why it takes 3 months if the board decides something in September to restore the Grosvenor turnbacks. Why can't that be done if the board votes something in September? Why can't that be done 60 days later at the start of November?
It's because of the union pick. The pick. Because you're changing the reporting locations for train operators, and that would become an issue with the union. So we have to do it either, the decisions would have to be made in time that we could either do it for the July pick, which is too late right now, I apologize, or the December pick. And that's the reason why we have to do it.
Is the December pick December 1 start, or is the December pick, when's the operational?
Mid-December.
But I assume that this is the kind of pick choice the union would like, because it means more work, more workers. So they might be, willing to expedite this a little bit, since it means that their members are going to get more hours and get more work. Isn't that correct?
Yes, but also we have to hire, we have to train.
You have to
more train operators to run this operation.
This wouldn't. So this is just not a matter of increased hours for existing operators. So I assume you could start that. Well, I guess you could start that activity as soon as the board actually authorized an increase in the budget for that level of operation, either going to 12 or 15.
We don't have to wait for the infrastructure improvements. Infrastructure improvements would definitely help us not only just maintain the service, reliability that we have right now, based on the current operation. But we would have, definitely have to change some of the work procedures and staff up Shady Grove in the beginning until the infrastructure improvements were made. We would probably have to do some additional staffing up in that area.
So assuming we could get some help from the union here, what's the training time involved for an operator? I assume this is someone who's either been laid off and will be coming back, or he's a bus driver or a station.
Right. And training them. So the ramp up for the 11 operators, we just have to do it. We have to pay for it, but, we can do it.
Right. Just what are we talking about? 3-4 weeks to train? What's a training?
For a train operator,
18 weeks?
Yeah.
For 18 weeks is 3 months, so all of these people, we're going to have to go through the 18-week training course before we can get the service restored? Okay, we'll see if we can expedite this a little
Thank
bit.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. We have
Thank you.
One more question over here.
Yeah, I just wanted, first of all, I apologize for missing most of the discussion. I'm on the Business Oversight Committee, which was meeting earlier this morning. And I just wanted to, so if I'm repeating what some of my colleagues have said, I apologize. But I just wanted to make a couple of points. One is that we're talking about this as if this benefits only Maryland, and I think that that isn't true. Certainly, this at this end of the red line, there are some major employment centers. Rockville is a very large municipality and employment center for the region, and I'm sure that there are people coming from all over the region who are trying to get access to this area for employment. So it's not – I don't like to see this sort of as only this will benefit Maryland, and certainly I will tell you that Maryland is not interested in reducing service or reducing power upgrades or reducing Silver Line service to any other jurisdiction. I mean, we're all about improving service, increasing service to all of our constituents, who in many ways are regional. I know a lot of the people who come from Maryland go to stations in the district and Virginia, and the same is true for the other jurisdictions. People are coming from the district and from Virginia and accessing these stations at the end of the red line. So I hope that we can approach this as a regional issue, something that all of us have an interest in.
Thank you very much for your comments. Any more questions? Seeing none, this meeting stands adjourned. Thank you, Mr. Leader.